My name's Dr. Brendan Kelly, and I have the privilege of serving as president of the University of West Georgia. And I want to welcome you to our podcast, Off the Cuff. We feature conversations with leaders and high performers from all walks of life. There are so many videos, seminars, and books related to leadership and performance. But perhaps the most insight that we're able to gain into those subjects comes from getting into the minds of leaders. Why they've taken certain actions or made certain decisions. How they prepare to win. Conversations with leaders and high performers create tremendous value for me. And I hope that this conversation creates great value for you as well. Today I'm hosting a conversation with Rochelle Robinson, and it is a leadership story of firsts. She was the first African-American cheerleader at Youngstown State University in Ohio, a CIA agent, and eventually elected the first African-American female mayor of Douglasville, Georgia, after a 140-year history of that city. Mayor Rochelle Robinson, how are you?
I'm great. How are you, Dr. Kelly?
I'm great. I couldn't be more thrilled to sit inside of the Douglasville City Hall right now with you that we can talk about you.
Oh, my gosh. And we're going to talk about you, too, because you're fascinating. You look like the Ken doll. People can't see you, but that's what it is.
I appreciate that. I'm going to pass that to the other Dr. Kelly. Hope she agrees with that still.
I'm sure she does.
So you're a pretty remarkable person, and my hope is we can talk about leadership and you being a high performer, because your life is fascinating. You grew up in Ohio.
Yes, sir.
And tell me about that, because I grew up in Michigan, and
yes, sir.
I think when you come from a Midwestern background and you end up in the South, there are just some things that you carry with you that are unique.
Exactly. Well, I'll say I grew up in a two-parent home. My dad served in the military. They were small business owners. He had a gas station, and he was a mechanic, the Martin's gas station, so he and his brothers. And my mom had a home-based business. We didn't know that was what they were called back in the day, but she sewed in our basement. So she worked at Minnesota Fabrics, which is now Hancock Fabrics. And she kind of homeschooled us. She was really, really into education. And ultimately, she was on campus at Youngstown State when I was on campus. So she eventually received her degree, and she was a director of Head Start. By the time I had gotten married, she recreated herself. But she stayed home with us. And so growing up in Ohio, we would walk to school, to elementary, middle, and high school. They were those kind of neighborhoods. And come home for lunch and have a chicken noodle soup and a peanut butter and jelly sandwich and go back to school.
That's right.
Our mom was there, and she did not start going working at Minnesota Fabrics and sewing until we were in middle school, like junior high.
Really?
Well, it was called junior high. I went to Princeton Junior High. So I'm from the Steel Belt, and it was a wonderful growing up. We had mixed communities. And so moving, like you're saying, from the Midwest to the South is drastically different. Lots of hospitality here is wonderful. Mm-hmm. But it's not as of a melting pot, I don't think. Yeah. Or you notice it more when you come to the South, I think.
Yeah, that's right. I grew up in Flint, Michigan, and was in the Detroit area for a long time, and it is. It's just a lot of different types of people coming together.
Yes.
Plus, when you say chicken noodle soup and a peanut butter and jelly sandwich, that was every day of my childhood.
Oh my
I love
gosh.
That.
And walking in the snow, they pushed the snow to the side, to the sidewalk, and it was maybe as high as you are, but you still walked to school.
That's right.
Went into the classroom, took your boots and hat and coat and scarf off and put it in a little cubby and sat down. And Mrs. Mark, I remember in the fourth grade, she used to play Stevie Wonder, "You are the sunshine of my life." And she'd walk around and talk to the kids and tell us we were special. And so when I was asked to come back to speak at Youngstown State University for Black History Month in 2017, she came to the event. And I was like, "My fourth grade teacher is here." So we were that kind of community where it's like, you know, Italians, Polish, black, white, just all mixed up together. It was a wonderful childhood.
I love that. Really,
yes, sir.
But in that melting pot, you also emerged as a leader and in some cases a breakthrough leader, because you went to Youngstown State.
Yes, sir.
Which I know you and I've talked to. You are very proud of your university.
I'm a
the same way as I love that. Absolutely love that. And you were in a sorority, and,
yes.
and still are affiliated with that sorority, the
yes,
Alpha Kappa Alpha sorority.
Yes, sir.
And I mean, I've seen you still wear your AKA jacket. You've got your bracelet on, right? I love that. So tell me about that experience, because that's you getting invited into a community, and mm-hmm. how does being part of a community like that shape you as a leader?
Wow.
And maybe on the alternative sense, how does that help you shape other leaders? Because you're still involved with mm-hmm. the sorority now.
Yes, sir. Wow, you have remarkable memory. I'm sure that's why your dissertation was probably something phenomenal, but you have a great memory. So I was on campus, and it's about 12% minority on Youngstown State University's campus. And so you kind of knew who the minorities were, who are the black kids from different schools. We had about 5 or 6 high schools, and so we came together, and you would know as Black United students, you kind of knew who each other were. And so these girls, I would see these ladies, they had pink and green, and some other ladies have red and white, so Delta Sigma Theta, Alpha Kappa Alpha. I didn't really know a whole lot about sororities because I grew up in the church, and my mom had us in church like 4 days a week. I'm going to missionary service, to the going to the old, you know, the nursing home. My mother had me reading to the seniors at the nursing
right.
home, singing Christmas carols. I'm like, Lord, you have mercy. But so on campus, I didn't really know a whole lot about sororities and fraternities. But they looked to be like they had it together. Those girls were cute to me, and they were kind of smart. And the one was a homecoming. She was on homecoming court. And so they approached me and said, you know, we are having a rush, and we'd like for you to come to the rush. And so I was like, oh, okay. So I went, and I'm looking around like, wow. Then they start... I don't know. It was a phenomenal experience because it gave me an opportunity to have sisterhood, but a belonging to people who had the same goals and aspirations that I did on campus. And so I was invited in, and I rushed, and I didn't go to the other ones because it's a different experience from like Panhellenic, which is African Americans yeah. fraternities and sororities, and the National Panhellenic. We had DZ and Phi Mu and all the other sororities on campus, and my friends who were cheerleaders with me, because I was the only black cheerleader, the first African-American cheerleader on Youngstown State's campus. And so my Italian friends or whomever, they would go to all the rushes. They're like, I don't know if I want to be a Phi Mu or a DZ or whatever, but ours was like, if you go to the AKA rush, you better not go to the Delta or Zeta rush. It's changed since, because my daughter, Olivia, is in the sorority now, and they have convocation at Kennesaw State, and so they're exposed to everyone. So they're like, we're going to present all of the sororities to you, and we want you to go and visit everyone. Don't, you know, segregate yourself. You may make a mistake. But she didn't. She stayed. She's legacy. She knew she had a choice. But it really has shaped me, as you said, because different places that I lived in, I was able to connect with those women with a chapter. There are chapters. There are 300,000 women in Alpha Kappa Alpha. And there's chapters everywhere, all over the United States and Bahamas and, you know, in England. My cousin is in the sorority, and she was in England for 5 years, and they have a chapter in England.
Wow.
And so in Surrey, England. So just having that connection. So everywhere I've moved, I've been able to connect with some women, or if they see AKA pink and green, they run up to you, hey, soror, which is short for sorority. Hey, soror, do you need anything? Are you okay? So it's been a blessing. And then you pass that on to help to have that connection on campus and beyond. So there's a young lady. She was the president of her senior class. Her name's Adari Murphy, and she's at University of West Georgia now. I had civic meetings with different pockets all over the city. And so I had a civic meeting at the conference center with all the high school senior class presidents. So all the 5 high schools in Douglas County. And she was the president of... the president for Douglas County High School. So I kind of mentored her, and she started UWG, and then she was like, I'm thinking about a sorority. I said, you're thinking about it? But now she's really involved on University of West Georgia's campus. I think she's a vice president of the sorority. I've helped her in the summertime to get connected with a job, and when she goes to conferences, I connect up with her. You all had Get Out to Vote or something on campus.
Right.
She asked me to do a promo. So it's kind of that thing that we give back. We leave those crumbs and footsteps for someone else to follow. So since 1908, we've been helping each other as African-American women. And we have a film called 20 Pearls. It'll tell you all about the sorority.
I love the narrative around that because you started with belonging and connectedness. And we talk about that a lot at UWG because that's our ambition for every single student we're in service to, whether you're a doctoral student or a 18 years old and you're walking onto the university campus for the first time, finding kind of nurturing spaces to feel belongingness and connectedness. And you mentioned the fact that you were the first African-American cheerleader at Youngstown State.
Being
president of a university that has 29 national championships in cheerleading and
woo-hoo!
The best cheerleading program in the United States.
Congratulations.
That's breakthrough leadership for you. I mean, you're a young person, and you don't mind going into spaces that were, made you the first. And it wasn't the first time, it wasn't the last time that you were the first.
Yes,
but I'm curious, how do you navigate that space, and how did it contribute to who you've become now?
That is such an interesting question. I need to sit down and write a dissertation on that because you're, okay, I believe my mom put in us as the four. We have two boys and two girls in our family. And she really said that we can do anything, as parents say to their kids, but you have to be prepared and you have to have the credentials for, or the skill set for what you want to do. But you can do it if you don't have fear. So you really have to put faith over fear. And that's who I am. Even at Woodrow Wilson High School, I was, the only African-American on the dance squad. I grew up doing gymnastics. My sister and I, I think because we were in those spaces, our mother made us go to Barbizon, which was like a modeling.
I know Barbizon, yeah.
Oh, my God. Standing against the wall with a book on your head, walking. And so she made us go in spaces where... And I think she maybe was traumatized. My mom's from Mississippi, and my dad's from Virginia. So they both come from deep segregated South. My mother was 6 years old, and she came with my grandmother. They were sharecroppers in Mississippi. My grandpa came to Ohio, started a farm, and he was there for like 3 years. And then my grandmother had to kind of escape at nighttime on a train. And my mom says she remembers that she was six and she had her shoes tied with the shoestrings around her neck. And she said, I kept saying, I need to go to the bathroom. And she said, my grandma said, shh, be quiet. Don't say anything. We can't go in this train. So they had to wait because they couldn't use the restrooms. And then she said they got to Ohio and she said the train doors opened. She said, I remember this so vividly. She said, the train doors opened and I looked and I said, wow, look at all that cotton. And she said, my aunt said, Hattie Mae, that's not cotton, girl, that's snow. So they were in Ohio. She'd never seen snow before. But she remembers taking that trek. But when she was in high school, a person said to her, my mother wanted to be a secretary. And she said, the lady said to her, well, you probably want to be a domestic. You can't be a secretary. They don't have black secretaries. And so I think my mother said, in spite of, don't let anyone stop you from doing whatever you have the talents, the gifts and talents and the education and the skill set to do, because like Dr. King says, you need to be judged on the content of your character, not the color of your skin.
Right.
I did things just because it was the environment that I was in.
Yeah.
So when it was on a stage where people could see me, it wasn't uncomfortable for me to do because I really looked at like, it's beyond what I look like. I mean, if I can do it, let me just step out there. And so that's what I would tell young people not to. I didn't see anyone that looked like me on the cheerleading squad, but I cheered in elementary, middle, and high school. I decided to dance. I'd been a gymnast in gymnastics. And so I needed some books, man. They paid for cheerleading, paid tuition for books. My GI Bill just paid tuition, but not room and board, and didn't pay for books. And so I'd call my dad, and I'm like, Daddy, on the payphone back in the day. They don't have payphones now.
They don't.
I'm in the bookstore. I'm like,
although we pay for plenty of phones.
And come on now. I'm in the bookstore. I'm like, Daddy, I have to get this history book. Da 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 da. And it was only $80, which is way back in the day. And he said, oh, I just got your sister a couple of books. You're going to have to wait a couple of weeks until I get paid again. And I'm sitting there like, it's already been 2 weeks. I'm behind in the class. Yeah. And I looked up and it said, cheerleading tryouts, free books. I was like, ooh. So when I walked in the room and people were all in the gym at Beegley Center, I looked around. I was like, oh, well, it's nobody that looked like me. But I'm used to saying my name is Shelly. I didn't know. YSU, huh? I didn't know that. And I didn't know guys were going to lift you up in the air, put you in the torch, and you had to do back handsprings and back tucks. But I learned real fast because they pay for books.
That's fantastic.
So I don't know if I answered the question.
That was great. That's great. So you're paying for books. You're flying in the air, which we get to see on campus all the time. And then if I understand the story right, you go to a job fair, which lots of college students do. Lots of college students go to job fairs. It's fantastic. I love when we can bring employers on campus and connect students to opportunity. But you go to the CIA booth. And then you go into the CIA.
Yes, sir.
So what's your real name? Let's ask that question.
Karen Zankis. No.
What type of work did you do? I mean, that is so unique, and people are just fascinated anytime they hear that anybody even touches an agency like that. Mm-hmm. But can you talk a little about whatever you can share? You know, the type of work that you did. But now you're the mayor of a city. I mean,
yes, sir.
What does being in the CIA do to fill your toolbox in a way that you can then, you know, have these next chapters in your life that are not the first African American female James Bond?
Right.
Although you may fall in that category as well.
Well, if I tell you, I have to kill you. No. Let's see. No, the story.
Actually,
I
have to believe that.
You
so
don't. He said when we first got married, I used to sleep like I'm gonna have my eyes open. I don't know what Rochelle's doing, but anyway, no. Like you're saying, they have job fairs. You're a senior, and you get your evaluation. They're like, you have these many credits until you graduate. So you're thinking, oh man, I need to get a real job now because my parents. I can't call my dad and beg for money or work at the pub. And it's going to be real life in a minute. I'm going to be 24 years old. Let me figure it out. And so I just was kind of walking and saw all the different companies. And so I was staring at the agency like, is this the Culinary Institute of America or is this the Central Intelligence Agency? I mean, who in the world? And so the guy asked me to come over and I start talking with him. And he got my information. But then I understand later, which I didn't know this part of the story, Captain Laverty, which was on, I was in the Army National Guard, and it was a military police unit, 437th MP Battalion. So Captain Laverty, once he called, the gentleman called Captain Laverty, said, oh yeah, I recommend, you know, Rochelle, her family. He told him about my entire, you know, my experience. They shared my record. He said, she already has a secret clearance. So they talked with the MP unit. And they recruited me after I tried to look at them. And that's kind of how it worked. And so I started having all these interviews in Washington, D.C., did a polygraph. They talked to Mrs. Mark, my fourth grade teacher. They talked to everyone. People were calling my mom and dad on the phone like, these guys came to our house in these black suits. What did your daughter do? And so I said to my dad, I was really afraid because we're a close-knit family. You know, my dad, like I said, came from Virginia and had a farm. This is going to be, like my kids always look at us like, that's kind of weird, Mom. But my dad's father came from Virginia and started a farm. My mom's dad from Ohio started a farm. And so they worked at the brick plant in Toronto, Ohio, in Steubenville area, where Dean Martin is from, Steubenville. Mm-hmm. And so the boys kind of married the girls. So I have cousins, like my dad and his brother, Drew, married my mom and her sister. Seven brides with seven brothers or 12 brides or whatever. So our kids were like, that is so gross. You guys are cousins. I said, no, we're not. They weren't really related.
That's right.
Yeah, they weren't really related. But anyway, so that's how close our family, really close-knit family, that cousins are. Everyone looks alike. Like, yeah, because my dad and her dad are brothers. And my mom and her mom are sisters. So I didn't want to leave Ohio. I was really afraid. And my dad said to me, once I talked with him, he said, well, you probably need to take that opportunity. He said, we have family in Washington, D.C. You can check with Aunt Lynn. He said, but you're just going to, I think you'll waste yourself away here in Ohio. He said, I think you can do it. And I was afraid. He said, and plus you'll probably just get fat and married and have a lot of kids. So do something adventurous. I'm like, okay, Daddy, I'm afraid. But I did. I stepped out on faith again. You know, I said, let me try it and see. Mm-hmm. How about that? I was athletic. So I went to the Federal Law Enforcement Training Center in Glencoe, Georgia. That's where CIA, FBI, DEA, all of the agents, all the across different entities go and train. And then you go back to your individual department. So after I did the training there, I went back to the agency and we went to the FBI Academy in Quantico, got some training. And then I worked in Office of Information and Technology, surveillance, and I did some recruiting for historical black colleges and universities. I lived in Helsinki.
So you lived in Helsinki because you're in the CIA.
Right.
So what happens then?
It was a great experience. But I just, a funny story about that. The Italian fleet would come, like, because Helsinki, I just love getting up every day. It's different from America. They have small refrigerators in Europe, so you have to go and get fresh food, which is great because that's what we're trying to do now. But the guys would wake me up, like, at the embassy. They're like, Rochelle, come to dinner with us, because the Italian fleet would come there. Did Michelle come to tell them? Sending food, wine, everything to the table. I'm like, oh my gosh, stop using me as a pet, as a catch. But it was wonderful. It's a great experience. The people were very, very nice, and I enjoyed it. But after 8 years, my mom said, would you please get married and have some grandchildren? You're going to be an old maid. You're going to go someplace in another country and get killed, and they'll tell us a different name. And because, you know, I would be gone for 6 months or a year and not be able to talk to my family. And so coming from that tight-knit family to not talking to my mom was difficult.
Wow.
But, yeah, it was rough. So I start crying at baby commercials, so it was time to get married. I see a Pampers commercial, I'm like, I want a baby too.
I love that. Oh, I love that. As a leader, mm-hmm. you're around a unique set of people when you're in federal service with the CIA.
Yes, sir.
How do you, are there experiences that you had mm-hmm. or skills that you built that influence how you lead now?
Yes, sir. Having said that, you are around different people, unique people. So I met Ollie North. Mm. There was a lot going on with him. And when I did the Black African American program, we would have, like, for Black History Month, Martin Luther King III, Mr. Farmer, Shirley Chisholm. And so it was kind of setting the program, you know, for them to come and seeing those people, like, face to face. And then for agents, you have to do, it's kind of not like a dissertation, but you have to do a report on something in history, in American history, and then give your perspective. And so for me, I did the assassinations. It has to be a true something that happened in American history, and you give your perspective from the agency or an agent's vantage point. And so my kids now look in a book I have, and so I have photos. I went to our library at the agency, so I have photos from JFK, Robert Kennedy, Martin Luther King, and Malcolm X. Wow. Those are the four assassinations that I covered for my report. And so I have the pictures of the actual agent that the agent had taken. So the kids look at my book and they're like, Mommy, how did they... Wow. Malcolm X is in the moss. I should have brought it up. Next time I'll bring it.
I want to.
When I come to UWG,
please.
I'll bring it.
That'd be
so
great.
So Malcolm X is in the moss praying, and it's just like you and I right here. And so they're like, Mom, how did they? No one's supposed to be in there. JFK's on the airplane, and he's looking out the airplane, and there's a picture of him right here. So, you know, the agent was always around someone.
Yeah.
And then when Robert Kennedy was killed and Rosie Grier was right there, there's a picture that's very close So I was just privileged to be able to have that information. I think it helped to mold me as a leader to see from different vantage points.
Yeah.
And how to lead from those different vantage points. Because America sees one thing when all those assassinations happen, but for the agent, they were in harm's way as well.
Yes.
To get a picture that close, or to be following someone knowing that those attempts were being taken on their, because it was such a volatile time in America during civil rights. So I think it helped to mold me to take things from another person's perspective.
Yeah.
Not to just say, okay, well, the policy says this. You know, like someone will call me now. They didn't pick up my trash. Did you put your trash out on the curb and it's so far away outside of, I don't know what's going on with that person. Let me call Mr. Greg, the sanitation director, see if he can go by and pick up the trash. But I think it helped to develop my sensitivity to people, because it's a big picture and there are always so many picture frames to the smaller narrative. A smaller narrative is always someone else's perspective. So as a leader, sometimes we may get lost in setting the policy or setting the standard or casting the vision, but it takes so many people to make that happen and to be able to come down sometimes and get the rope and pull with them makes a difference.
Oh, that's fascinating. Well, that's absolutely wonderful.
Oh, thank you.
So you take all of those skills and abilities, mm-hmm. And you come to Georgia, to Douglasville. You're an ordained minister.
Yes, sir.
You then start getting involved in this community.
Mm-hmm.
And in each setting, you kind of either end up or run toward leadership.
I know. I don't know what's going on with me. I'm on punishment.
Glutton for punishment. That's it.
I know.
But that includes you starting to serve as a public servant.
Yes, sir.
You serving on city council, and you becoming the first African-American female mayor in Douglasville in 140 years.
Hoo-wee. That's heavy.
You need a T-shirt, Youngstown. I mean, it's impressive. But each time, you don't mind being first.
I don't. And you know what? I don't even look at it like that. I don't even know if I know the history. Sometimes it's a need. Like, I needed those books. I needed to, you know, I went to the military because I needed my college to be paid for. And in the agency for FLETC, I was like the soldier of the cycle. When we go back to my office, you can see my little award. Like, I won the Iron Man, whatever. It's 500 points. You have to do all these different things, and I think I got 498 points or whatever.
Wow.
But I threw a shot put in high school. So I don't know if I know the history or if it's just a calling that I feel like I have to answer.
Mm-hmm.
And again, go back to the things done while you're developing that people don't see. Like, my mom had us, when I was in the fourth grade, we marched on the Board of Education. And I didn't understand it. I was like, because I said she had me at the nursing home, I was always going with the missionary group somewhere.
Yeah.
But there was inequality in books. And so we were like one of the second African-Americans in our neighborhood. We lived next door to the Tassons and the Mottarellis. And so she said, we're going down to the Board of Education and we're going to march for equality in books because they're sending books that are not up to par to South High, to South High School. I went to Woodrow Wilson High School. I didn't know anything. That's the high school I was zoned for. And I said, why are we going down there? It doesn't affect us. And she said, Rochelle, if it affects one, it affects everyone. We're all one community. So you're going to go down there and march too. And I had a little sign.
Wow.
Walking around this, you know, equality in books. So she said, when you go to a community, try to make it better than when you got there, before you leave or make a difference. And it's your responsibility to be part of the community. So when I came to Douglasville, you know, I wanted to sit on the row like the first lady and put a hat on. My husband's a pastor. I was like, oh, I'm just going to sit down and have my children and have them run around and they'll say, first lady, what do you want? Tell us, I want a cup of tea. But that didn't happen.
No.
I got here and...
No, you're the mayor.
I'm the mayor. I got here and someone's like, you know what? You know stuff about politics. You need to run for city council. I said, I don't think so. But I ran for city council, and I became a city council person. Served in Ward 3, which is predominantly minority. Mm-hmm. It's on the northern part of Douglasville. And so did that for 4 years, celebrated too much and got pregnant. I thought, Olivia and Joe, I have my two kids, a boy and a girl, life is good. But then Anna came. I said, oh, Lord. So after that 4 years, I said, I'm going to take a break. I'm out. I'll just, you know, serve on. I was on the West Georgia Technical College Board of Directors, mm-hmm. Wellstar Hospital. I'll just serve in the community. I love serving. It's so wonderful. But it's kind of like the mafia. I'm from Youngstown. When you get out, they want to pull you back in. So people kept saying, you need to run for mayor. You were a great council person. You need to run for mayor. And I said, nah. But then I thought about it, prayed about it. And I said, you know, I can cast a larger net if I run for mayor. So that's what I did. And then I realized, I kind of probably knew, but I didn't really know. You're going to be the first woman ever and the first minority ever since 1875. I said, really? That's crazy. For real? But anyway, that's how it happened.
But that's why, you know, I joke about it frequently when we're together, but every time we're in a room and public officials introduce themselves, the minute you introduce themselves, everybody applauds. They're not applauding everyone else. somehow.
Oh, gosh. But I lost my first race.
Really?
Yes. I ran in 2011, and there were four of us in the race, three men and myself, mm-hmm. and I won the general. But in Georgia, you have to have 50% plus one,
right.
And I did not have the percentages. It was probably like 48 or whatever. I was going into a runoff with 1,200 votes more than the second vote getter.
Wow.
And I got overturned. I lost by 88 votes.
Wow.
People didn't come back and vote. They're like, oh, that girl got it. She's leading by 1,200 votes. It's raining outside. I'm not going back to vote. And they didn't. And I lost. And so 4 years later, I ran again. But in those 4 years, we couldn't go to Red Lobster, Publix, without people saying, are you going to run for mayor again? We need you to run for mayor. I was like, gosh. And the kids would start taking notes. How many, let's take a bet. How many people are going to ask her today? My husband's like, Rochelle, just run for mayor again. They're driving us crazy. So I ran again in 2015. Three guys and myself again, and it was a runoff again. I said, oh, Lord, this is the same. It's like Groundhog Day. What? I don't know what I'm supposed to learn. I'm going to lose again. What's going on? Because at this point, you understand the magnitude of what it is.
Yeah.
Like it's always been, you go to the museum around the corner, and there's this big picture, pictorial of all the mayors, and they're all stately white gentlemen. And I'm like, oh, man, it's not going to happen. But wow. I did again. And that day was December 6, 2015, was the runoff. And my husband ran in the shower when I got out of the shower. He said, Rochelle, it's going to be different today. I said, why? He said, today is the day that Rosa Parks sat down on the bus.
Wow.
He said, it's the 60th anniversary for Rosa Parks. I said, are you serious? I was like, you know what? It is going to be different today. So we went through the runoff and we voted that day. I won every precinct and unseated the seated mayor. And every downtown where the big antebellum homes, I mean, Chapel wow. Hill, the North Side, Tributary, I won every precinct. And I started crying because I thought about it. I was like, you know what? Rosa Parks sat down on the bus so I can stand and my daughters can run. This is great. That was a good day.
That is remarkable.
That was a good day.
Wow. So I'm gonna ask you one final question, if you don't mind, because your story, what you've accomplished, is amazing. But there's some remarkable accomplishments that are making this city and this county better as a result of your leadership and other wonderful public servants who are really investing themselves in this place. So knowing all that you know from your cheerleading days and sororities and being a CIA agent and being the first female African-American mayor of Douglasville, Georgia,
mm-hmm.
are leaders made or born?
I think it's a combination. Because really, I'm a shy person.
Yes, I'm sure. Yeah,
I am shy. Yeah,
I'm sure. Deep inside, I'm sure that's true.
When I take the Myers-Briggs, all those, I'm on the cusp. I'm like, you know, extrovert, introvert. I'm right on the line.
I think you're cheating on that exam.
No, I'm not. I sat under the steps and read Little Bear when I was 4 years old. I can read books. All I want to do is read a book. Sit at the house. We have books in every room of our house. I mean, I love to read. My mother may have put something in us, and our dad was the quiet storm. I don't say a lot about him. But he was very intellectual. He's very smart guy. He didn't have an opportunity to go to college. He went to the military, but he could fix anything. He would have been an excellent engineer. They tell me when he was little that he built a car out of parts, like from the neighborhood. He would just go get all these parts and build a car. And they had him in the newspaper when he was like 12 years old or something. But he was such a steady, calm. He didn't want any trouble. My dad was just... But when he said something, it was like E.F. Hutton. Everyone got quiet and listened. So I think their stability made us a leader because they would push you out there. But then being born into that family, too, of pioneers and people that wanted a better life, you know, leaving as sharecroppers from Mississippi to Ohio, a better life for their kids, you know, being in the segregated South. So it was something about the character of the person. Mm-hmm. And naive, I don't know if I'm naive or not, but I just believe in everyone there's some good. You know, I look for the silver lining. I look for, like, if someone calls and complains about something, I'm like, they're having a bad day. Let me just figure out what's going on. And I try to be an optimist. And I have one daughter who is 100% the optimist, Olivia, and Anna is the realist, like, I don't know. So Olivia, she threw up when she was like 7 years old over this beautiful pink dress with the little twirlies on her socks and pink patent leather shoes and her hat and gloves. And she just said, it was her birthday. She said, oh, well, at least it's a beautiful day. So that's what my husband's like, what? We heard that noise in the back, like, oh no, is she gonna? No, not all over the dress. I just found a pink dress. And she said, well, at least it's a beautiful day. So we stopped at Target, got her some sweats, cleaned off everything she had on, pink patent leather shoes with some sweats and a t-shirt at church for her birthday. So I try to look at, even if it's a throw up day, you know, throw up situation, at least it's a beautiful day.
That's fantastic.
I'm alive. It's a beautiful day. I'm not on my cooling bed.
I love having the opportunity to go through your experiences in your life. And you have so much to offer the world, and you're doing such a fantastic job. This is a real privilege. Thank you.
Oh, thank you for having me. I'm so humbled that I am sitting here with you, with someone of who you are, the president of a university, thinking that I'm enough, I'm a poor church mouse, to like talk to me about about anything. It's just life I'm trying to live. And I think it's a lot of people just like me. They just don't have an opportunity to have a megaphone and tell people.
Well, that's if that is true, I'm very grateful that you've taken advantage of your megaphone in the way you have.
Thank you, Dr. Kelly.
That's fantastic. Thank you, Madam Mayor.
Sir.